That's Covet, I believe. Now we no longer have to have our gums scraped. Good morning. Welcome to the program. Very nice to have you all with us. It is Tuesday, the 24th of June. And I will say, just spending the last 5 minutes with the panel in our pre-show warm-up, they're very keen on litigating the past. They're very keen on making right of the last couple months. But we're going to talk about what's happening today, and as it's happening this morning, and we welcome you in that pursuit. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to have you be a part of the program. And whatever you've got, we got a lot of letters yesterday. I assume we'll get a lot of letters today. This is always the case, but especially in days like today. Keep them short, keep them to the point, and we can get to as many as possible. We whipped through quite a few yesterday, which is very nice when we're able to do that. We, as I said, we have a stellar group of individuals today to talk about what is and what is not going on in the world. And let me welcome them and introduce them properly to the proceedings. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing fine. The word of the day?
Yes.
Hydrate.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. It's very hot, very humid, and we want everybody to be safe, and please heed all warnings and
check on your neighbors.
Do the things that you need to do in such weather.
Be good neighbors.
And hopefully one more day, and then we'll be
fine.
Yeah, and then things are supposed to get, you know, then non-normal again, because I think like the high on Thursday is like 65.
Right.
But whatever, we can take what.
Just be careful.
Exactly, Teresa. We welcome the Joseph Palamountain Junior Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin is here. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Hi, Joe. I'm great. I'm thrilled to be back.
Very nice to have you back. I greatly appreciate you being here as always, especially on a day like today. Thank you so much. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is back where he belongs, and we thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, we missed you. Yeah, you were out traveling.
You were doing some fundraising too.
Well, that's true. That's true. You actually, in that sense, you were off at a good time.
Yeah.
I guess we really didn't miss you that much, did we?
Listening attentively to. I was stuck in a traffic jam in Virginia for an hour listening to the end of the fun drive, and it was exhilarating while I was so incredibly angry.
Well, and yesterday we had the show, and you know, we got done, and then Mark Whitman wrote me a note, and he said, "Here are my 2 cents on the show." And I said, "Oh, this is great. He makes really good points. Hey, Mark, do you want to be on the show today?" And invited him on, and he said yes, and we're thrilled. Investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I wrote in primarily because I was so impressed with the show yesterday.
Yes.
I must add a disclaimer at the beginning of the show today. There's been a lot of discussion in my home about some of the events that are taking place, and I've been told that I have to say that my views do not necessarily represent those of the Whitman Mask household.
Wow. Buckle up, folks.
Got it.
Okay, then.
Got it.
That's got to be fun.
Yeah.
Appropriate disclaimer.
That's good. See, in my house, I don't think you would know because, we all just, you know, say our things, and then if you don't agree, you just shut up. You know, and, but that's good. I'm glad you have that open dialogue. Welcome all, and again, we welcome your thoughts, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So just since we went off the air yesterday, when I say we went off the air, when the show ended yesterday, when the panel ended at 11 o'clock, since that time, there was a strike on U.S. targets from Iran. Those strikes were intercepted early afternoon. Then a short time later, the president came out and said that a ceasefire had been reached between Israel and Iran, and that would take place over 6 to 12 hours. Then the ceasefire became a fragile truce. This morning around 7:30, the president on the in the front lawn of the White House today said they don't know what the F they're doing. That seems like maybe it's being the truce is being tested, but the president lashed out at Israel and Iran on Tuesday for launching attacks after he had announced a ceasefire, highlighting the fragility of the deal that seeks to end 12 days of deadly fighting. In expletive-laced remarks to reporters, Mr. Trump said he was not happy. He sharply criticized Israel for firing on Iran right after we made the deal and said the two adversaries didn't know what they were doing. A White House official said that Mr. Trump had spoken with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel on Tuesday morning and was firm and direct about what needed to happen to sustain the ceasefire. Mr. Netanyahu's office said that Iran had fired missiles after the ceasefire took effect and that the Israeli military had retaliated by striking a radar system near Tehran. Iran's military denied violating the ceasefire, and Mr. Netanyahu's statement indicated that Israel's retaliation was limited, which could suggest that both sides want the truce to hold. In a Truth Social post, Mr. Trump said that Israel is not going to attack Iran and that all planes will turn around and head home. Those comments came before he left Washington for a NATO summit in the Netherlands, where a Middle East truce, if it holds, could give him a chance to claim a diplomatic achievement in a conflict that had threatened to escalate. Let us begin with our August group this morning. Bo.
Joe, I think so it's been dizzying since over the last 12 hours. And in fact, I did a good amount of preparation last night and I woke up this morning and things were changed. But let me try to build off of the show yesterday, which I agree was fantastic, and think about a couple of different questions, throw them on the table. First, in no way am I defending or justifying Iran, but let's think about Iran's foreign policy and ask ourselves, is it rational, right? The answer is yes. Iran's foreign policy is rational. They are distrusted in the region. Their defensive strategy is threefold, right? They have ballistic missiles, they have nuclear threats, and they have proxies, and they play unconventionally, especially with the proxies, but they are trying to survive. The administration, the regime is trying to survive. And in conversation with my great colleague, Ferriaz Ojakli, he told me, you know, at the end of the day, he studies Middle East, at the end of the day, Iran is just the Iran administration, the Iran regime is trying to survive. And American commentators do not understand that these are the ways in which Iran is trying to stay in the game. So question number one, is Iran's foreign policy rational? The answer is yes. Question number two, does American commentators misunderstand the foreign policy? Yes, it's always framed in the context of the war on terror, Israeli interests, Gulf state trade, which I'll get to in a second. Three, are there other states in the region that are supportive of the current situation? And I'm not talking necessarily about the ceasefire. I'm talking about the bombing over the weekend of the nuclear, of Iran's nuclear capacity, the battle with Israel. Are other countries in the region supportive of this? The answer to that is yes and no. Yes, a nuclear Iran is a serious threat to other countries in the region. No, other countries aren't thrilled with it because what's happened is Israel has not just reestablished its dominance, but escalated its dominance in the region by essentially wiping out Hezbollah, Hamas, ballistic missiles. The Iranians are running out of ballistic missiles. The nuclear threat is potentially diminished, and a powerful Israel in the region is scary for Arab countries in the region. So the answer is, if other countries in the region are supportive of the events, the answer is yes and no. Four, I only have five. Will regime change happen in Iran? The answer is going to be no there, right? You think about Arab Spring. You think about the ways in which the infrastructure for change has to happen in places like Tunisia and Egypt and so on. That's not a theocratic Iran. There's no chance there's going to be regime change in the way in which Trump wants it to happen. And so ultimately, the final thing I'll say before I throw it out on the table is, could this whole thing backfire on the U.S. and Israel? And the answer is yes, right? One, I thought the group yesterday did a great job of talking about asymmetrical responses from Iran. There's going to be asymmetrical responses. Sure, the bombing of the Qatar the bombing of Qatar was just a potential saving of face. But the last thing I'll say is, if Israel kills the supreme leader Hamani, and I'm not support, I don't have a position on that, and shut down. Remember, Hamani shut down weapons production, or at least slowed weapons production in 2003. If you get somebody in there after him who is much more radical or a maverick, you may have that nuclear option come back on the table in Iran, and Israel is going to be in a worse place than they were before. So can this whole backfire? Can this whole thing backfire on U.S. and Israeli interests? The answer is yes. I'll stop there. I got plenty more to say, but others do too.
Excellent. Nicely done. All right. Teresa. Do you want to go first,
I'll
or do you want,
no,
do you want to defer to Mike?
I'm
okay.
Deferring to these guys.
All right.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Bo. That was very thoughtful and provocative, and it sets the table pretty well for us. yeah, what I worry about is that, you know, and I'm just reflecting what a lot of people have observed, is the U.S. is really good at this kind of thing, going in and blasting away things, not really good at the next step. You know, how do we get out of this? How do we end this? And if there is indeed a ceasefire, which it sounds kind of like there is, I really do hope so. That is remarkable, and we certainly should be glad about that. I mean, over the weekend, there was a story leaked out of Washington that the Ayatollah had warned Trump that we have sleeper cells around the country, in the United States, and there was going to be retaliation. And that just scared me, because it brought back memories of post 9/11, where we were suspicious of anybody with any kind of Middle Eastern connection, or even appeared to be Middle Eastern. We'd look at South Asians or something and think they're Arabs, and we'd be all upset. And you know, I don't know where Persians fall into that, you know, and how you recognize who is what, but it creates this whole distrust, confusion, anger, and it's not good for our country either. And like I said, I hope that this ceasefire does hold. I think it would be really problematic. I completely agree, Bo, if there was regime change. By basically taking out killing, as in uppercase letters, as Trump said, the theocratic leader, the Ayatollah, who is the head of state in Iran, and the chaos would not be good. I so regret that I know there were problems and questions about whether the Iran nuclear deal that was brokered during the Obama administration had continued, but I think we'd be in a better place right now. I thought that had great potential. It's too bad that it just was canceled by President Trump in his first term, and now we're sort of trying to get back to that using force, and, you know, that's not always the answer. It's useful sometimes to show force, but this is a precarious situation that is still playing out. It's probably going to change during this morning show.
Well, that's right. It is ever changing. Mark Whitman.
What are we doing for time, Joe?
Well, you go ahead. We'll get opening statements from everybody, and then we'll take a break after
okay.
that.
Okay. So let me respond to some of what's been said. First of all, I think Trump and Netanyahu did the right thing, and I think we all have to acknowledge it's for the wrong reasons. And I think the wrong reasons are what we need to focus on now in terms of the cleanup after the fact. But I think for us in the U.S. to sit here and say, yeah, it's okay, Iran may have been months, a year, some bit away from getting a nuclear weapon, but we should just let that ride. Maybe we can talk it out, given our decades of history trying to do that. I think given that we had a clear opening to take military action, believe it or not, I think Trump did the right thing, but for the wrong reasons. I mean, Netanyahu wants a forever war for his political gain and in defense of his position, and he's gotten that at the expense of the Gazans and now the Iranians. And I think Trump wanted to get part of the credit. I mean, Trump's a lot like a dog you take for a walk. It pees on the fire hydrant and walks away, and it thinks, I created that fire hydrant. And that's the way Donald Trump thinks about geopolitical events all too often. You can see that here. I think it's already happened that the Iranian regime has become more hardline as the theocrats are diluted and younger, more recent military commanders are becoming a larger part of the regime. I think it's true that any regime change, frankly, would have led to a military coup, basically. And so I think in the short term, that would have been disastrous. Over the intermediate and longer term, you can ask a different question because that's a broken society. But we can get back to that question later on. I do think what the U.S. should do now is use its newfound authority with Israel to put pressure on Israel to stop the war in Gaza as well. I think that's the reasonable thing to do here. I think both Netanyahu and Trump are using the pyrotechnics as a way of diverting from other things that they need to focus on. So in a way, my summary is, two guys sort of for wrong reasons stumbled into the right answer. There are lots of right answers that we need to pursue after this, but I think the world's in a better place now that Iran's nuclear capabilities have been attenuated. And I think, frankly, it's arrogant for Americans sitting all this distance away to say, yeah, we should have just let it ride. I think that's absurd under the circumstances.
Teresa.
Yeah. So I'm interested in more, Mark, about why you think that it's clear that they've come to, that they did it maybe for the wrong reasons, but the right thing. I mean, I think it's still a very open question of whether or not the Middle East is more stable, whether or not the world is safer, whether or not we have greater protection from the use of a nuclear weapon this week than we did last week. Particularly, having spent more than $1 billion by some calculation in this Saturday night attack, what calculations are, what changed, in how did things change in what direction? Frankly, I thought that Trump was headed in a much better direction before what I think Netanyahu clearly steered him toward this decision to use the bombs. But I think it's going to take some time to really determine what is happening with their program, with the Iranian bomb program, right? And now it will be even less transparent. I mean, we lost enormous transparency when Trump tore up the agreement, right? The prior agreement. So the monitoring wasn't there and so on and so forth. And now, as a former colleague of mine who was on CNN the other day, Saturday and Sunday, he said, you can't bomb away knowledge, right? They have the capacity to develop a nuclear weapon. And Wendy Sherman said the same phrase last night, former, I think, both Clinton and Obama diplomat, and I think she was Biden as well. And they still have the capacity. So what's next in this talk of regime change? Regime change to who? Certainly, it was a government that didn't have much, as much public support, but now probably has much more support than it did Friday, right? And and what would be next? Who's in line to take over? So I think that there are a lot of open questions about what the long-term impact of this is and how much damage they really did to the Iran's capacity.
Do we have a second?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I agree. What I would say is a nuclear-capable Iran is worst-case scenario, right? That is...
They're still nuclear-capable, aren't they?
Well, weapons-grade nuclear-capable Iran is worst-case scenario. And so, you know, I don't take... Trump's word is hollow and meaningless. That said, are we closer to being at the negotiating table about a lessening of the capability, nuclear weapons grade capability of Iran today than we were on Friday? I think this is where I think, despite the fact that I'm a little nervous about it, I think Mark is right that the answer is yes.
Aren't they more determined now than ever that they feel that they're going to need that capacity? And it's so much less transparency now.
Well, are we closer to the table, Teresa? I think the answer is probably yes. I mean, one of the things that you know, there's a lot of saving face that's happening in Tehran at the moment, right?
They're saving and in Israel and in the U.S.
For sure. Right. But in Tehran, right, they're trying to save face in an environment in which they're the weakest of the three. And so is there an incentive for them to come to the table? The answer is at least a little bit. And for me, that represents some level of progress.
I really thought that Trump was in the right path when he was saying negotiate. And clearly, Netanyahu shifted him to the bombing path. And I don't know, you know, maybe I'm hoping that in the long term it's the right thing, but I don't think we know that right now. And I don't know how much they really degraded their capacity. We don't know that yet.
I mean, Biden's administration's, you know, intelligence community argued that they did not have the capacity to produce. Iran did not have the capacity to produce, weapons grade, to produce a nuclear bomb. Essentially, that was sort of the opinion. Tulsi Gabbard and her group continued that up to a few weeks ago before Congress, and Trump has been convinced the otherwise. And I don't know I don't pretend to know the answer, but I don't think anyone does.
But the IAEA,
I actually do, Mike.
IAEA,
I think the answer is no. I think the answer on that one is no.
Pretty much no. How close were they, though?
Listen, I think you can sync up all the reports you've heard in the following way, and I've heard this analogy somewhere else, so it's not mine. But if you think of the final act of creating a bomb as getting in a kitchen and plating the dinner, right? The Supreme Leader said, "We're not going to plate the dinner." So
right.
the chef was in the kitchen. And was told, you're not plating dinner. But the sous chefs had been told, particularly by the military as of late, I want you to be at the door of that main kitchen with everything ready as quickly as you can so that the chef can plate it all. And it's not Tulsi Gabbard doesn't think anything. She was reiterating what her people were telling her. And actually, intelligence assessments from the U.S. from Israel were highly correlated. What happened was Netanyahu took the inch and went a mile because he wanted to make the threat more imminent for his own personal reasons. But one of his reasons, actually, I think, was legitimate in taking. By the way, and this is where I take issue with some of what Bo said. When taking out Hezbollah, they showed the utter folly of this of using proxies as a defense system. They also took out the air defenses of Iran, despite the fact that Iran had actually literally altered photos to claim that the Israelis hadn't done as much damage. And there was a moment now where you could basically get a free pass at taking a shot at their nuclear program. Netanyahu wanted to do that. Granted, a lot of his own political reasons, right? His own political future, to get the world's attention off the atrocities in Gaza and the rest of it. But there was a window. And by the way, the other thing I want to put out on the table is, does anyone in this room think that the Israeli Defense Forces, who promised that when they started this, they were going to attenuate Iran's nuclear capabilities, does anyone think
that they didn't have a plan to get at what we bombed. Because I'll tell you, I strongly suspect they were going to take a commando raid where they couldn't bomb it and take out what they could. So if you look at the U.S.'s decision, they probably went to Trump and said, look, we can put a lot of people on the ground, probably lose our Israelis, definitely lose a lot of Iranians, get the Middle East in, you know, really riled up because we literally have the boots on the ground, which seems to be a red line everywhere, right? Or you can fly those babies over and take that out. So I think, by the way, I think a lot of – I agree with the criticism of the press. I think a lot of this, you know, the press does a lousy job. You have to read a lot and synthesize a lot to understand what's really going on.
Many in the media.
Most in the media. There are very few exceptions,
but Mark,
frankly.
You're assuming that the sous chefs are no longer capable of doing what they were capable of doing last week in Iran. And how do you know that to be true? There's no evidence yet that's true.
Given the plan that was the way the plan was formulated and executed, and given the original assessments, I agree it is unknowable exactly what happened. But I also think there's lots of reasons to believe the sous chefs have been dealt a pretty significant blow and that there's a delay. Teresa and Bo, I grant that until the Iranian government comes to the table in good faith, Israel and the United States is going to be playing whack-a-mole with Iran from now until the day that Iran either develops a nuclear weapon or develops a disposition towards not having one. But I would also claim that playing whack-a-mole, if that's all we can do, is the game we should play rather than have them get a nuclear weapon.
And what's happening in the White House is exactly this conversation. They might have a little bit more information, but nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, or beyond. And so I think, you know, I'm not defending the White House. I think they're a bunch of buffoons. That said, the reality out there is just in the last 12 hours, we've seen shifts and pivots and changes and so on. I think by the time we finish this show, things are going to be different. So how do you make strategic, right? This show is great at talking about the differences between tactical and strategic decision making. Tactical decision making is in the moment. Strategic decision making is long term. And I don't think anybody in this room or in the White House knows exactly where we're going to be. All I'm saying, Mark, is that I think, and Teresa, I think we're slightly 5%, 10% closer to the negotiating table today than we were a few days ago. And that's hard for me to say.
Mission accomplished.
We need a big banner, Joe.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Mike Spain, Bo Breslin, Mark Whitman, and Teresa Bourgeois make up the group. We welcome you as well. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we welcome you. We are talking about the, we'll say, fragile ceasefire that seems to be in place. The president showed some concern this morning, and there have been conversations, so we'll see where this leads over in the hours and days to come. And our group is addressing that as we speak this morning. Mark Whitman.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about losing transparency. The IAEA, right, is the organization that's been responsible for that transparency, allegedly. I suspect in Israel they call them the EIEIO bunch, because Israel has a tremendous amount more transparency into what's going on in the nuclear program. I mean, they know where these guys live, sleep,
their phone numbers.
Their phone numbers, where to put the envelope threatening them under their door. So until and unless Israel says we need the IAEA for transparency, I'm going with the Israelis given their recent past. Now, that doesn't mean I want to overly lionize, you know, their military prowess here, but I will say they seem to have plenty of transparency into what was going on there.
Teresa, seem like you want to say something.
pulling the mic close. What was your clue?
She was pulling the microphone close. Her eyes closed, and then she seemed like she was trying to control herself.
Was it the red beams from her eyes on my skin?
I
just, you know, denigrating the IAEA. Is that the card you're playing? That are you serious? Are you serious? You really think that the IAEA doesn't have an important role?
I mean, they have a very important role, but if I had to pick one, I'm going with the Israelis until they tell me they've lost visibility.
Two in a row, Teresa. I don't disagree with you, but two in a row, I'm agreeing with Mark on this. That is to say, the Israeli ability to figure stuff out is as good as any in the world.
I'm not saying it's not, but what does the Israeli government doesn't have a requirement to be transparent about what they know.
Agreed.
The IAEA, that's their role, right? Their role is to come in and make it clear to everyone. And I think that that has for a long time been an important role. And it has, when they've been allowed to do their job, it contained Iran for a long time. And there's a whole set of factors that would help contain Iran as it has contained other countries from going the next step to get the bomb. And my only point is to have an active ability to, you know, ability to use a nuclear weapon. And so my only question and concern is, are we more at risk today than we were last week of Iran moving quickly to having the active capability of a bomb? And I think the answer is yes. And I also think we are more at risk because there's no capacity for the IAEA to be in there and look, which is the neutral arbiter. We won't know. Maybe Israel might know more, but we will not know that. And by an aside, under the Trump administration, our intelligence gathering capacity has been greatly diminished, and that worries me a lot. And it also that also worries me because I think we are at much greater risk now of these, you know, indiscriminate attacks that Mike, you were talking about earlier, being worried about. And you know, the retribution will come, but when, where, how, we don't know.
Or just the fear of it.
Is our country as prepared now as we were 6 months ago to have the right eyes and ears to track that, to try to prevent it?
Remember when Soleimani was assassinated in 2020? Iran did the exact same thing. They let Americans know they were going to bomb our base in one of the bases in the Middle East. And quite frankly, there was, as I said, this sort of low-level asymmetrical response that happened after that. And we kind of claimed victory because the Iranians let us know ahead of time. Teresa and Mike, I'm with you on the fact that we're not sure what's going to happen, but Iran is going to do something and a series of somethings in the next year or two as response to this.
Well, I think if that fear, and I think it was clearly discussed within the administration. And by the way, when you think about the administration, there are certain levels that we don't trust, basically Trump's appointees. But I still believe there are plenty of really smart people who think about these topics, and hopefully their voice comes through. I actually think when Trump was talking about regime change, he was worried. I mean, we dropped the bombs, and he's thinking, okay, if they do what we expect them to do, which is kabuki theater, we're good, which is what they did. But I think he was worried that there would be something that none of us could have predicted, and I think that's why he brought up regime change, because I suspect they sent a message to the Supreme Leader saying, your bunker isn't nearly, we know where it is, and it's not nearly as deep as the one we just hit.
He did it on Truth Social, I believe.
Yeah, but I'm sure they sent a behind-the-scenes message.
Hold on, one at a time.
Because I'm sure the administration doesn't really want to deal with regime change in Iran in the next 2 weeks. That would be, they know that's a mess. I'm not even convinced that the Israelis wanted it. I think the Israelis did a lot to the theocratic and military leaders, including, as we've all read, calling up the ones they hadn't assassinated, saying, if you don't turn, we'll assassinate you. I think it's pretty clear they got a lot of their sources out or deep enough back undercover that they wanted to stir the pot and get the Iranians focusing on internal politics just as much as the external volleys that were going on.
And again, I think you need to sort through all this. So when the media says Trump wants regime change, I don't really think that's what happened when he writes those Truth Social reports. And when they say that Netanyahu, I mean, do you read? Okay, everybody raise their hand here in the studio or at home. If you think that the head of Israel calling for regime change in Iran is going to bring people to the streets of Tehran, right? So we don't think that's why he did it. There was another reason in the press. Back to the press, Joe, they do a horrible job. They never really got into why he did it if it wasn't for regime change. But I think it was to add to the overall turmoil in Iran at the time.
Can I, to the point that you made a bit ago about how there's some people in the Trump administration that are really worth listening to, I think General Kane right now is a person who is, if you listen carefully to what he's saying, I think it's very important right now to be listening carefully to what he's saying, because I think he's speaking the truth more than some of the others in a depth of understanding. You know, what he's saying with a depth of understanding and with the long view, I think he's worth listening to. And he's saying things a little bit differently than the others. Yeah. And also, there's been a bit of commentary, Maggie Haberman, who from the New York Times, who really seems to understand Trump like no other reporter does, about how the adjustments the Pentagon has had to make because of the things that Trump has either said or put out on Truth Social that they have had to, you know, reprogram around to deal with the implications of things that he said because it wasn't part of the plan. And so I'm not sure that he was really signaling anything when he talked about regime change or in any planned way. As your analysis seems to be that he was sending some prepared message. And I'm not sure if
I think it's clear that regime change isn't going to happen in a way in which the U.S. and Israel want it to happen. Right? It's not going to be clean in any way. And I don't think it's going to happen in the first place.
But I guess the question is: was it strategic or was it reflective?
I think he was just blurting.
Yeah.
But by the way, about regime change, there is no liberalizing force that has leadership in Iran currently. If you look at the wake of the women's protests, the one report I heard said they imprisoned, tortured, or killed most of those leaders. So they're gone. So the point is, the only people left with power are the guys with the guns, and they would be a worse or certainly not better option in the short to intermediate
term. True, but I'm with you all on this, but correct me if I'm wrong. The sentence after on Truth Social about regime change that Trump issued was I'm paraphrasing, the people of Tehran have a responsibility or should take to the streets, right? That's simply not going to happen. The people of Tehran
are
not going to take
to the streets. Certainly
not after Saturday. So, you know, I think regime change is farther off now than it was before. Let me just throw this. Let's assume for the moment that Trump is interested in, and I can't assume it, but let's assume for the moment that Trump is interested in maintaining his pledge of not getting in a long war anywhere in the world, much less in the Middle East, right? That was a campaign pledge. Let's assume for the moment he did that. So the question becomes, why did he bomb? He can say, one, it was a one-off, like some of his cronies are saying. Two, I think he was tired of hearing from the press that none of the other, whether it be Reagan all the way through to Biden, none of the other presidents were willing to go that mile. And he wanted to show that he's different and a change maker, and he's going to uproot and upheaval the Washington establishment. And his answer to that was, we're going to drop bombs on Iran because none of the other presidents were willing to do that.
But a different take on that is, all of the other presidents understood that you shouldn't do that.
Right, and I'm saying...
The thing about Trump is, he was headed down the negotiation path. That's what he pledged in his campaign. And he completely violated on Saturday what he pledged in his campaign. right? Completely violated. Now, maybe it'll turn out to be a good thing. Maybe it'll turn out to be a bad thing. I don't know. But it completely violated what he pledged in his campaign. So that bridge has been crossed.
I agree.
So presidents from, starting with about Carter, I believe, have all pledged that Iran nor Korea will go nuclear. Korea's gone nuclear. Iran is still now even further from it. Why the difference? Difference is...
You don't know that they're further from it, Mark.
We suspect. Okay.
But you do not know that.
I want to hear the difference.
Listen to General Cain.
I grant that there is an unknowable, but I think we are further from it.
It's a little premature for the cheerleading.
Okay. All right.
But why the difference? Because at any point that we would have taken a shot at North Korea, they had the conventional ability to decimate Seoul with artillery. And we couldn't take the shot. Why did no president before Donald Trump take the shot at Iran?
Because of Israel.
Ray's laughing at
because
you,
because Israel and the United States were terrified that the proxies were going to unleash a conventional response on Israel that would be catastrophic. The moment Israel solved that issue, and by the way, when they solved it, Iran was even publishing doctored photos of their air defense system saying, no, you missed, you really didn't hit us. The moment there was an opening, I postulate that any of those previous American presidents would have taken that same opening and bombed. I think Obama would have done it. I think Clinton definitely would have done it. I think it's pretty obvious. We got a chance at a free shot. They didn't even fire a shot at us.
I agree with you that Netanyahu was pressuring Trump to go in, and he did it. I don't know in the long term if that – maybe it's going to be for the good, and maybe this is a one and done, or maybe this is the beginning of another 20-year war. I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
This is us really litigating the past like Joe said we were going to. I'm not sure Obama would have taken that shot.
Right.
Mark.
I don't think so.
I wasn't looking to do that. I was. That wasn't my goal. It wasn't my aspiration.
What are the listeners?
I postulate he would have. The other thing, just remember, I'm operating from the premise that the Israelis went to the administration and said, when we said we have a plan to take care of all these facilities, we weren't kidding. And if you don't help us, here's what we're going to do. And this is going to be worse for us and for you. Why don't you just drop the bombs?
All right. With that said, we'll take a break. And I think it's needed. We'll take a break. We'll... calm everybody down. And we have a lot of letters, so we'll get to those on the other side. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. He fired everybody up, you group. 1-800-323... No. That's can you believe I did that, Ray? A week
it's
later.
Hard, I want Ray to sing it.
Hard to lose.
Oh, my God. Wow. I didn't do it the entire drive.
Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Yes. Thank you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel. Thank you, Mike.
Whatever.
Always
panel,
helpful.
Panel.
We'll be back right after this. You know, they've got opinions. They've got a lot of opinions, and they share only a portion of them with you on the air, because if they shared their other opinions, we wouldn't probably have a show. Let me introduce the group to you. They're fantastic. Teresa Bourgeois here, public policy and communications expert. Bo Breslin, Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor, and Mark Whitman, Investment Banker on Wall Street. And, of course, we welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, as we talk about the military action that took place over the weekend and the fragile truce that seems to be in place at this moment. We have discussed this over the last hour, and now we open the mailbag and let you have your share your thoughts on this. Ricky says, "Dear panel, if President Trump, having successfully inflicted massive damage on the Iranian nuclear weapons program, can avoid involving the U.S. military in a new, quote-unquote, forever war in the Middle East, then he will have made a major accomplishment for which he deserves credit." And that is from Ricky. Then we go to, and anyone who wants to comment on any of these letters, please just jump in. We go to Kevin, who writes, "Good morning. We could spend days, months, and even years talking about Iran. I know it's called job security." But history is very clear regarding Iran's intentions toward the West, and all the talking heads in the world will not make a difference. If Iran, I think you all make a difference. If Iran satisfactorily puts a nuclear warhead on a missile that can reach either Israel, Europe, or the United States, then they will launch it. And if you think differently, you are extremely naive. Have a great day, says Kevin.
But don't you think, listener, that if they were to successfully do that, it would result in a retaliation that would level, Iran? I mean, don't you think so?
He's saying that there are other things to be talking about. Is that the point?
No.
Because, I mean, I certainly think the budget and so many other things.
But the latest comment was that if they had a nuclear warhead and could deliver it, they would. And if they did, what would the result be? And I think they know what the result would be, and that's why I don't think they would.
Let's go to Ildo, who says, pardon my ignorance, but why is it acceptable for countries like the U.S. to have nuclear weapons while others like Iran are not allowed to develop them? Isn't that a double standard? Also, if we build and stockpile nuclear weapons for our protection, couldn't other countries see that as a threat and feel justified in attacking us first? Am I misunderstanding how this all works?
Yes.
Yeah. No, you're not.
You missed the last 80 years of history.
Yes.
And I'd suggest CNC also the last 80 years of history since World War II. By the way, the issue about Iran having a nuclear weapon, and this also gets to this letter as well, if you look at how effectively Russia has used uranium-tipped threats against the West in order to have its way with Ukraine, you see that you actually don't even have to believe that the theocrats might use a weapon, but that having it affords them a great degree of freedom in terms of what they do militarily with others in conflicts.
But the question now is, will Iran...
And we don't, and to the most recent letter, I'm sorry, Teresa, we don't do that.
Teresa.
But the question is, will Iran now feel an even greater need to move closer to having full capacity for a nuclear weapon?
I think it depends.
And will it speed up their efforts as opposed to has the environment been created so that they feel safe without having one? No. Right? No.
Well, I think that, Teresa, I think a couple of things. One is, what is talked about at the negotiating table, assuming there's a negotiating table? And we haven't talked yet in this conversation about sanctions, right? The Iranians would love for the sanctions to be lowered. And so if the story can continue to be, oh, you bombed us, we took a step back, but we still have the capacity for weapons-grade nuclear capability, lower sanctions for us, then at the end of the day, Iran gets a little bit of an advantage from this particular moment. So I think the story out of Tehran is going to be that we still have that capability. Do I think they actually have the capability? I do think we took a step back.
One of the things that I've been wondering about and trying to figure out where I could find people who understand this to explain to me, I don't. On the one hand, Trump repeatedly denigrated Obama and Biden for lifting some of the sanctions on Iran, right? Providing them. They gave them money. They gave them money that allows them. But on the other hand, with Syria, he immediately lifted some sanctions on Syria because they said they have, with the new government, they have to have a right to exist and grow and see if they can develop. So is that a contradiction? Are they different cases? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not saying they're the same. I'm saying I don't know. But again, this goes back to, was Trump before Saturday on the right path to try to have a negotiated agreement with Iran? It's too late. It's in the, you know, it's already passed. But I think it seemed to me he was moving in a very good direction on that.
Well, the question is now that there's a ceasefire, is there an opportunity to do exactly what you guys are saying, and that is for the West to negotiate maybe removal of sanctions that would open the path for the Atomic Energy Watchdog, the IAEA, is it, Teresa?
IAEA, yes.
Yeah, to come back in and kind of get back two steps backwards and slowly move forward. Because as Mark was pointing out earlier, might have been during the break, that Iran's economy after the 1979 revolution where the Ayatollah came back from France and it became a theocracy. After that, their economy has just slumped, and they were a Western-leaning nation up to that point, and they may want some of the people of Iran may want some of that back and be willing to, you know, negotiate.
And the, what I would add to that is there's a difference between regional geopolitics and national negotiation and diplomacy. And so what worries me is that there is this, that the Trump administration has a national individual approach so that they can lift sanctions in Syria, but they're not going to lift sanctions in Iran. And there isn't the broader 10,000-foot regional geopolitical conversation going on. There is a difference between lifting sanctions in Syria and lifting sanctions in Iran. Syria is a shell of Iran. Iran is the Arab power in that region, right? Militarily, it's the Arab power in that region. And this is where Mark is right. Like, if you can make the argument that that Iran has nuclear capacity, then that is leverage. That is power for that particular country. My worry is that the Trump administration does not think regionally. They think nationally.
All right. Go back to letters. And let's go to this one from Ryan. Can the panelists weigh in on whether the U.S. itself is at danger of an attack from Iran? Who would Iran want to bomb, assuming they even managed to develop a nuke? And this is brings up the question when you say the U.S. itself. I mean, obviously, right after this, there was a lot about our bases and where we have a presence around the world that were possible targets. I read into this letter, though, here within the United States.
I think it's clear that Iran does not have the capacity to deliver a bomb across the Atlantic. I do think where we are more in danger, and this scares the hell out of me, but where we are more in danger today than we were just a week ago is with sleeper cells in the U.S. and especially in Europe. So there is going to be, as I said three times, there is going to be that asymmetrical response. It's going to be somewhere in the U.S. and/or Europe, and that's where I think Iran has capability.
I don't think we can dismiss that risk, but I think we can minimize our fear of it, because I think this current administration, back to the Trump comments about regime change, I think if there were to have been a sleeper cell that let something off and you picket Civic Center in the United States, that they would have a different supreme leader this morning. So, and I think they knew that. And I think the regime wants to perpetuate itself. And so I think that's a credible threat that will minimize the chance that that happens.
All right, let's go back to the letters, and we check in with, we welcome yours, by the way, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Dave writes, late in World War II, while the Germans were having their cities bombed and firebombed and the destruction to their industry was extreme, they took a lot of the equipment from their aircraft factories and moved it to the basement of individual homes and kept up the production. All the centrifuges need not be in one central location, but if they diverted a portion of them, they were built to smaller unknown locations, They could use the 60% enriched uranium to spin up the 90% weapons grade in a relatively short period of time without any eyes on them or awareness that these distributed facilities even exist. And that is from Dave and his thoughts on this matter. We go to Kelly. I read that Iran moved their nuclear equipment prior to the bombing, similar to the letter prior. So I can't understand why anyone thinks the bombing was effective.
Well, first of all, even if there was no nuclear material, there's a reason they spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars, putting a facility in under a mountainside. No, those centrifuges and the arrays do not get reconstructed in somebody's basement. It's a tough technical problem. It takes a lot of effort. Additionally, Israel now claims they know where the fissile material or the potentially fissile material is. They claim they know where it's been moved to. So I think that should reduce our fears. And I would add that even under the auspices or prying eyes of the AIEA, we just call them EIEIO, but the Iranians were cheating on them to begin with. I mean,
so
even
I guess not.
Even yeah, even this Fordo facility was a hey surprise. Guess what we've been building while your inspectors have been here. So you have to take it all as a whole. I agree. There's a risk things got moved and the mission was not as effective as some might hope. That's different than saying it didn't deal them a significant setback. It's also reassuring that the Israelis say they still have eyes on where some of the critical components have been moved to.
And let's also remember a couple of things. One is that the Gulf War states, just the Gulf states, right? Saudi Arabia, UAE in particular, their interest is economic trade, right? Their interest, Trump went there and had his little, his tour of economic investment in those. And the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates in particular, they want a stable regime, the stable region, in order for there to be incredible investment. Who's going to invest in the region now, today? Right? I can't think of anybody who's going to invest in the region today. So my point is, those Gulf states also have an interest in making sure that Iran doesn't have the nuclear capacity. And so I think it's a pretty concerted effort to make sure that that they don't ever get weapons grade, or at least in the short term, get weapons grade capacity.
I'm a little confused. It's a serious question here, but the Trump family is just, you know, they did the Middle East tour with his trip recently, sure. And they're heavily invested in the region.
No,
so
I'm
confused about you saying, did I misunderstand what you're saying? Because you say who would invest in the region? Well, the Trump family has invested heavily in the region.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being a little hyperbolic. I'm being a little exaggerated when I say who would invest in the region. But it is a much less stable region today than it was when Trump went a month ago, right? So my point is, let's think about the interests of the other countries in the region, and in particular the Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and UAE, that absolutely do not want powerful Iran, B, bombs and bullets floating over their countries, right, and C, this sense that that the region is unstable. They want to have, these Gulf states want to have incredible investment and trade in the future, whether it's from the Trump family or from other American and European and Asian entities. They, too, have an interest in making sure that Iran is not nuclear capable.
Oh, well, then can we, since we've mentioned Saudi Arabia, let's just quickly mention another reason that Saudi Arabia Iran would have done damage if it got too close to a nuclear weapon is that countries like Saudi Arabia would have been basically forced to develop their own. And globally, this sends a much better message than the alternative that we're not going to allow nuclear proliferation. And in a distorted way, it's particularly potent message, an important message to send as the United States under Trump draws back our security umbrella around the world, because that in and of itself will likely motivate others to consider arming themselves
with nuclear weapons more seriously. So to put a marker down in terms of not allowing proliferation is actually perversely an important thing that Trump has done, despite the fact that he's motivating others to take a more serious look at arming themselves.
Okay, I'm going to belabor the point. That all assumes that it was this one weekend bombing was successful at deterring proliferation. And I don't know that we know that yet. In fact, I worry it's the opposite. I worry that it will accelerate it, not degrade the proliferation.
Oh, I've got good news for you. I can maybe allay some of your
fears,
because I think the message that we sent between us and Israel was that you're right, there's a chance, right, that this mole pops its head up again and they start to recreate what they had or get closer to a nuclear weapon. The good news is we have a pretty effective hammer and we're not afraid to use it. I think they should take the message away that we'll use it again and repeatedly.
Well, that presumes, okay, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The United States may destroy the Fordo enrichment plan. It won't make the Iranian nuclear threat go away.
Of course.
This is from the experts.
I agree with that.
I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about. I just read the experts. Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
I think we attenuated it.
I think if you're reading the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, you have some idea of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Just to know where to get
yes,
that is
I'm
pretty
saying,
impressive.
Where are those bulletins, Teresa?
No, I highly recommend if you're interested in
you
this
know,
issue.
Here's the way I look,
look at the
is,
Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Chalk
seriously.
Chalk up this round to the good guys. We're not done with this fight. The only way the fight would have ended is if Iran got the nuclear weapon and used it.
Oh, but we're not done with this fight is
no,
absolutely
yeah.
terrible news for MAGA Republicans who believed Trump would not get us into
because
this fight.
Because he said he would not do this.
Of course.
And he was on a path
and
to
I
negotiation.
Say, right.
It was
I,
his better angels. He was on a path to negotiation.
Well, okay.
Anyway,
but also, and still telling, I mean, still saying that, right? I mean, laying down the wall that we're done. We did it. We're great. And I mean, you look at any of the thing that came out of Truth Social from 10 to midnight last night, and it was pictures and only Trump can do this and dot, dot, dot.
But is that the real world or is that the kind of television show mentality that he has? I mean, he's creating his own reality. Oh, there's a ceasefire. There's a ceasefire. Is there a ceasefire? Isn't there a ceasefire? We'll see over time. Did this accelerate Iran's move toward a nuclear weapon or did it stop it? We don't know that yet. I hope it did. I fear it didn't. I'm repeating myself.
Yeah, so, but
what are the letters?
What I find interesting.
Sorry.
Are better.
I didn't mean to
Letters are better than
no.
bow.
No. I was saying to myself, I'm being redundant, interrupting the letters. That was to me, not to you. Sorry.
No, but what I think is fascinating is you have Republicans in Congress and around the country who believe what Mark is saying, right? Who say, oh, this is a one-off, and that the threat, the possibility of the threat that we could drop bigger bombs, will constrain the Iranians. Yet that threat is exactly what Trump wants to avoid, right? Or that possibility, because if it happens to occur and he has to drop a bigger bomb, then yes, we're one step closer to the forever war.
We dropped the biggest bomb we have. The attack cost more than $1 billion.
Disagreeing with you, Teresa. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying
there's no bigger bomb to drop except for a nuclear weapon.
There are many more bombs,
yes,
and many more days, weeks. It's not a 12-day war anymore. It's a 3-month war, and a 3-month war becomes a 3-year war, and all of a sudden we're in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Well, this is what I wonder. A baby born on Friday, will they be going to war in 20 years based on what happened this weekend or not? I hope it's not. But is this the beginning of a 20-year war, or is this the end of this phase of Iran trying to get a bomb? We don't know that yet.
Teresa, I think your analysis is incomplete. It's not whether or not they rush.
Actually, Mark, looking at the clock, because of the gravity of the way you said that. Teresa, I feel that this is incomplete. I think I should give you time to fully be able to articulate that. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear the whole enchilada as it is, and we would love to hear from you as well. Panel at WAMC.org as we finish out our time together on this Tuesday morning. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this news from the BBC. When last we left the chess game.
All right.
Welcome back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us as we finish up this round of the roundtable panel for Tuesday, the 24th of June. Teresa was speaking and talking about some of the issues that we've been speaking about throughout this morning. Mark said that he had some concerns regarding that.
Explaining why I was wrong about everything.
Yes. Well.
We're gonna hear why I'm wrong about everything.
I think it was incomplete. The analysis was incomplete. Yes. So Mark would like to make that more complete, and we turn it over to Mark now.
Look, I think the fact that we took care of a mountainside lair that took hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to build and made it inoperable, most likely, is a big setback. I think the formula we have to use to decide if we're better off is not how big was the setback, but was the setback big enough to compensate for any increased interest that the regime has in building a nuclear weapon. I think we've probably done that. I think we've also made it clear that we're going to keep threatening them if they continue to build. And so I also think, you know, you can blame Trump for not negotiating, but last time I checked, it takes two to tango. Now, you know, sending Witkoff, you know, the ambassador to everything, I wouldn't say necessarily gives this country the best chance of coming to an agreement with anyone. I think we need to use people who are focused on one topic at a time and maybe a little bit more well-briefed than Mr. Witkoff is. But I think it's a lot more likely we're going to come to an accommodation with Iran. And I'm a little surprised that we've at least given them a ceasefire for nothing at this juncture. If I were Trump, I would have done three things. I would have said to the Israelis, I'm using my political clout to tell you now to get your boot off the throat of the Gazans. And I would have said, but I'm going to let you work over Iran until Iran agrees that they're going to quit it with the proxy nonsense and that they're going to come to the table in earnest and acknowledge that beyond a civilian nuclear program, they're not going to be running around with 60% enhanced uranium in that country any longer. So it's not that I don't think we've motivated them to think long and hard about why they would want a nuclear weapon or even given them more reason in one sense to want it. It's that the offset is we've shown our ability to attenuate that and we've shown our ability to threaten them. And we've made it clear, I think, that we'll continue to do that if we need to. So I do think we're safer than we were.
Just one part of that, you're suggesting.
I was going to say, you seem to be. Like, you don't
I really want to get
that
to immigration.
Far apart.
I just want to get to immigration. Yeah. But the one thing you said is if the Trump administration has an interest in getting Israel to pull back on Gaza, they have shown nothing. They have shown no inclination to get Israel to pull back on what Israel's doing in Gaza. So I'm not sure why that you factor that in. Why you think that would be something that they would press Netanyahu to do?
Oh, I just if I were Trump on the day after, right? And by the way,
but that presumes that that's something Trump's interested in.
He's
and
made
no interest.
Well, interestingly enough, right? Both he and Biden have made noises about Israel knocking it off in Gaza, but both of them have been led by the nose effectively by Netanyahu.
I can't even go down that road. What you just said.
We are never going to get to deportation unless you stop.
I think we should let
you. Yeah,
all right. Here
let's
we go. The Supreme. Okay, but just know that you're also partially driving the train here. And maybe not driving him, but at least reaching over for the steering
grabbing
wheel.
Grabbing the steering wheel. Can we steer toward deportation? That's upsetting me more than Mark is.
The Supreme Court for now is allowing Trump to deport migrants to third countries, quote unquote. The case centers on President Donald Trump's attempt to deport migrants to countries where they are not citizens, including conflict-ridden South Sudan. The Supreme Court cleared the way for the Trump administration to deport migrants, temporarily blocking a decision by a lower court judge who said migrants must have a, quote, meaningful opportunity to contest their removal. Go, Teresa.
So I'll leave it to other people who actually read the Supreme Court dissent. So I didn't have a chance to do that. But I just think we have to keep in mind the data that fewer than 30% of the people that ICE is detaining are thought to have any criminal convictions, and roughly 7% are thought to be what Trump claimed to be after, which are violent criminals. And some of the people that are being detained are thought to actually be American citizens. And so what's happening with detention right now, I think, is truly un-American. It has to get much more sunlight. And some of the cases that have come up even just over the last 3 or 4 days of people being beaten, of a father of 3 Marines, of a wife of a Marine who has a 9-week-old child who's been taken into detention, and they're trying to do accelerated deportation, and on and on and on. And so now we're not only deporting them, but the Supreme Court says that the Trump administration, not weird by the Trump administration, wants to deport them to Sudan. Seriously? A country where the State Department has all sorts of warnings about don't go there, it's absolutely not safe. Is this who we are as a country? Are members of Congress, Republican members of Congress in the House and the Senate, what does Senator Thune think about this? What does Congressman Lawler here in New York State, is this where we are as a country? I find it stunning.
What I find stunning is that the Supreme Court let this go.
Absolutely.
I mean, by basically, saying let the lower courts arguing it out and continue to argue it out, and we won't take a stand on it now.
But in the meantime, they can deport them.
Yes, exactly. Letting it continue rather than doing what they need to do. It's passive approval of this, and it's outrageous, and I think you articulated it brilliantly. I agree with you.
Yeah, so from a Supreme Court perspective, from a constitutional perspective, what is problematic, Teresa, I totally agree with you. Mike, I totally agree with you. The fact of the matter is it's un-American. The Fifth Amendment means something. The 14th Amendment means something, all of that kind of stuff. I want to focus on the shadow docket, right? The studies have shown that the shadow docket, this docket in which the Supreme Court makes decisions without that are largely procedural, not merit-based, and without the full information, has doubled since Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Jackson have come on the court, right? So when I teach my students constitutional law and civil liberties, we talk about cases that are merit-based, but most of the work, or a good portion of the work, because only 60 cases get to the merits every year, a good portion of the shaping of American constitutional law is taking place at largely in the evening without the large number of pieces of information, oral argument, and full briefing that we have come to appreciate and get used to. So the Supreme Court, this is a recent phenomenon, the shadow docket was not used very much in the past, and when it was used in the past, it was an individual judge who had to do it. Now you have 6 judges who are willing to use the shadow docket to advance largely conservative agendas, and that's a shame.
Teresa, I find this stomach-churning. I also wonder where the Eighth Amendment comes into play here, right? Protection against cruel and unusual punishment. But I have an honest question. I come in peace on this.
I love being on with you. I'm serious.
I know.
This is discussion.
I saw your laser eyes warming, though, so I just wanted to say that. I don't understand how the majority justifies letting this take place. The majority of the Supreme Court justifies letting the deportations take place while we wait for this to percolate and be settled. I can't even play devil's advocate. I haven't heard an explanation.
It's so clearly wrong.
But have you even heard? But let's put our partisanship aside and let's try to understand that argument. I haven't even heard it.
Yeah,
formed.
I can't think of.
And they didn't articulate it in writing.
Well, so Sotomayor does a great job in
the dissent, of
describing essentially what the majority did, right? And she calls it lawless. She calls it lawless for a couple of reasons. One is violation of basic Fifth Amendment due process. But also, Congress has passed laws that require particular procedures when you're sending someone to a country that's not their origin. And largely the administration and now the six members of the Supreme Court ignored those congressional pieces of legislation. So, Mark, I'm no lawyer, but I am a constitutional scholar. I cannot articulate a rationale for why the majority did it, aside from this ongoing embrace of unitary executive authority.
And those deportees, we'll call them, who were headed to Sudan, who were deterred, they were sent to Djibouti, right, and being held there along with ICE officials. What's that costing all of us? Now they don't fall under this, and they are getting their due process finally, right? And they're doing it, I guess, over Zoom or whatever it is they're doing. But I also think that we have to pay attention to how much more of this that the Trump administration plans. If you look at what's in the reconciliation package, $46.5 billion for border barrier construction, $45 billion for adult and family detention. They want to create 100,000 more essentially private prisons, these detention centers, which there's all sorts of reporting about the harsh treatment that's happening there, not enough food, not enough beds, not medical care. And $45 billion at the same time they want to cut $32 billion out of housing, right? And remember the outcry about all the money that was being spent for hotels for immigrants? They want to put $45 billion more into the pockets of their private detention centers who have all sorts. This is how they want to spend our tax dollars, folks. Is that really what we want?
Teresa, I applaud you for foregrounding this because I think the risk is when I go back to the doing the right thing for the wrong reasons in Iran, I think, you know, the administration and all the pyrotechnics are in some part motivated by an attempt to distract the good people of this country from some and much of the stomach-churning policies that the administration is enacting in this country.
Can I say something? Look at the videos. It's heart-wrenching. People keep, over the last 48 hours, a number of my friends keep sending me these things, and it really is. You have to watch it because you have to understand what's going on. People being beaten, people being handcuffed, people being surrounded by people with weapons, but no identification of who they are in the United States of America. But on a positive note, in San Diego, the new appointed bishop, who's a he came here as a Vietnam refugee, and he's now the newly appointed bishop. He went with the Episcopal bishop, the local imam, and 10 other clergy to the San Diego immigration courts to just be a witness to what was going on. And a group of about 30 people stood outside praying, and they went in, and the ICE people who had been in the hallways left for the day. And the judges, they assessed, made rulings that they gave people more time as opposed to sending away. It made a difference. Just bearing witness made a difference. And the question is, what people are concerned about this do about it? And that was one thing I thought in a little glimmer of hope.
Well, we're going to end on that glimmer of hope, and thank you for sharing it this morning. To Mike, Bo, Mark, and Teresa, you're all wonderful. I appreciate you being here. We'll be back right after this.